Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Sarah Newman, and I'm a third-year law student from the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern. Together with Marjorie Felice, I represent the appellant, Tara Luvano. This court should reverse the district court's dismissals of Ms. Luvano's viable Title VII claims. First, this court has jurisdiction to review and reverse the district court's July 9th dismissal of Ms. Luvano's first complaint. But second, even if this court doesn't reach the merits of the first complaint, this court can still reverse the district court's March 24th dismissal by holding either that the fourth complaint relates back to the second complaint under Rule 15C, or by holding that equitable tolling applies. Now, Your Honors, reversing the district court's threshold error, its July 9th dismissal of Ms. Luvano's first complaint, would resolve all of the issues in this appeal. To be clear, this court has jurisdiction to review that July 9th dismissal. The district court's July 9th minute entry was solely interlocutory. There was no final judgment entered at that point. In fact, Ms. Luvano still had, at the very least, 5 days remaining on her statute of limitations clock on July 9th. Ms. Luvano could not have appealed that minute entry, the dismissal of July 9th, on July 9th. As a result, the case was still alive in the district court, and it remained under the general rule that this court has recognized. That is that dismissals without prejudice are not final and not appealable orders. Now, there is no authority from this court that supports Walmart's argument that the July 9th dismissal somehow became final on July 14th or at some later date. Lee versus Cook County and Elmore versus Henderson, which Walmart relies on, did not establish a springing judgment rule. Instead, Lee and Elmore only recognized two very narrow exceptions to the general rule, and neither of those exceptions applied to this case. These exceptions only apply in cases where either the complaint can't be saved through amendment or, as was the case in Lee and Elmore, the statute of limitations has already run on the day of dismissal. Now, Walmart, however, would have this court expand Lee and Elmore and establish not only a springing judgment rule, which this court expressly disfavors, but a springing judgment rule that would be based on an affirmative defense, which at that point had never been raised in the lawsuit. In short, the jurisdictional question facing this court was answered very clearly on July 9th. There was still time on the statute of limitations clock on that day, and so the general rule applied. Ms. Luvano now properly raises that July 9th dismissal from the ultimate final and the final judgment in the district court on March 24th.
Ms. Newman, go ahead.
Well, the district court's express language in that dismissal order makes it very clear that she was not yet done with the case. She anticipated the filing and, in fact, invited the filing of an amended complaint and a reconsideration of the informa pauperis ruling.
I agree, Your Honor. It was clear that the district court did not believe she was finished with Ms. Luvano's lawsuit.
And both Lee and Elmore dealt with orders that dismissed the actions as opposed to just a complaint, a distinction that our case law has recognized, not always consistently, but has long recognized.
Correct, Your Honor. In this case, Ms. Luvano's complaint was dismissed. Ms. Luvano's lawsuit remained on the district court's docket after July 9th, so the July 9th order can now be appealed from the district court's final judgment on March 24th. Now, moving on to the merits of Ms. Luvano's first complaint, Your Honors, Ms. Luvano really should never have had to file amended complaints because she pled plausible claims for relief from day one of her lawsuit. Ms. Luvano initiated this lawsuit by filing the district court's own form complaint for employment discrimination cases.
Do you happen to have figured out when that form was last revised?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. But Ms. Luvano accurately filled out that form, and she also checked the box for sex to designate the basis of her Title VII claim. On top of that, Ms. Luvano was very diligent and attached an additional statement of facts that gave more details about the underlying factual circumstances of her claim. That statement's on page 26 of our appendix. First, Ms. Luvano explained that her supervisor admitted to her that he would not respond to a valid complaint about a coworker because the coworker was a man. She also explained that the supervisor himself intimidated and harassed Ms. Luvano, And Ms. Louvenneau also explained that her supervisor reduced her hours after she reported the supervisor's misconduct up the chain to the district manager. Now, regardless of what pleading standard applies, and that is somewhat unclear, these allegations were enough to survive Section 1915 screening. Now, even if this court doesn't review the first complaint, this court can still reverse the district court's March 24th dismissal by recognizing that relation back under Rule 15C applies. Now, this issue requires the court to fast forward to Ms. Louvenneau's fourth and final complaint. This fourth complaint preserved Ms. Louvenneau's second retaliation claim, which she raised in a second additional charge to the EEOC. First, in terms of timing, the math is very simple, Your Honors. The second complaint was filed within 90 days, as required, from the second notice of right to sue letter. And second, substantively, relation back from the fourth to the second complaint is appropriate. The facts alleged in Ms. Louvenneau's second complaint arose from the same conduct as her second retaliation charge, which she attached to her fourth complaint. First, looking to the allegations in that second complaint, she alleged that the retaliatory conduct in the second complaint was a reduction in hours that took place on April 8th. That clearly took place after she had filed her first EEOC charge earlier the month prior in March. On top of that, when describing her own protected activity, Ms. Louvenneau referred the district court to Walmart's anti-retaliation policy, which she attached to her second complaint. And in that attachment, Ms. Louvenneau highlighted the provision prohibiting retaliation for filing EEOC charges. Now, that's on page 43 of the appendix. Now, given that Ms. Louvenneau's second complaint was filed pro se, the district court still should have been leniently construing that complaint and should have drawn all inferences in her favor. The facts that I've explained demonstrate that the retaliation claim in her second complaint was a new claim that was not brought up in her first EEOC charge. Now, when Walmart raised timeliness as an affirmative defense to the amended complaints, Ms. Louvenneau properly responded by attaching her second charge to her fourth complaint, demonstrating not only that she had exhausted administrative remedies on that second retaliation claim, but also that her second complaint was timely.
Would you agree with me that it was not even necessary to file the second EEOC charge under our case law? I have in mind the Cheek against Western and Southern Life Insurance line of cases, and in particular McKenzie against Illinois, where we said, look, you don't, if you're being retaliated against for filing an EEOC charge, we're not going to send you back to the EEOC. You can just go ahead and bring that issue straight to the district court.
Certainly, Your Honor. Cheek recognized that claims can be reasonably related. If there's a new claim that comes up in a complaint that wasn't an EEOC charge, the district court can properly review that. Ms. Louvenneau, who was proceeding pro se at the time, was just being extremely diligent by raising that issue to the EEOC. In fact, the legal standard for analyzing retaliation for filing an EEOC charge is a little bit different, so Ms. Louvenneau was simply exercising an abundance of caution by filing that second charge.
Is that the import of the footnote in the briefing in the district court that appeared to relate to an exhaustion requirement as opposed to a relation back requirement? I'm trying to keep those two
correct
issues separate here.
Yes, I think the footnote you're directing me to is in the record on 51, the note 3.
Yes, I don't remember the page, but yeah.
The district court was improperly analyzing the relation back argument at that point. Relation backs, in this case, merely served to correct a technical deficiency. Failing to attach the EEOC charge was really only the basis for Walmart later raising an affirmative defense, as it did, but it wasn't a basis for dismissing Ms. Louvenneau's valid amended complaint on that claim. I see I've entered my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve that time.
You did better than that. You ran out of time altogether.
Her colleague will be doing rebuttal, I think.
Thank you, Judge.
You are.
All right. I think next up is Ms. Zeitler.
Yes. May it please the Court. Norma Zeitler on behalf of Walmart. First, I'd like to address the jurisdictional issue. And I understand that this Court's precedents no party has found any precedent that talks about what happens when a dismissal order is issued without prejudice and subsequently the statute of limitations runs, which is exactly what here, what happened here. In Muzikowski, a complaint was dismissed without prejudice, and subsequent to that dismissal, this court found that it had jurisdiction to hear the appeal of the dismissal without prejudice because the statute of limitations subsequently ran. Now, in that case, the statute of limitations ran 9 months later, but I will say, as my duty to the court, that also the plaintiff had pleaded, had stated in open court on the record that he didn't want to amend his complaint. So perhaps that was what led the court to decide that it had jurisdiction. Our suggestion, though, is that when a dismissal without prejudice becomes final because the statute of limitations runs, at that point in time, the plaintiff then should file an appeal. The second issue with respect to jurisdiction goes to the notice of appeal. The notice of appeal said that Ms. Luvano was appealing from the final judgment. And the entry of final judgment was as to the fourth complaint. There was no discussion in that dismissal about the dismissal of the first complaint.
Why does there need to be? We've got tons of cases saying that a notice of appeal from the final judgment brings up any interlocutory orders along the way.
I understand that, and I guess the suggestion, Your Honor, respectfully, is that it, once the decision of the first dismissal became final because of the statute of limitations, then it was no longer interlocutory.
Well, then the argument becomes circular. Okay, or that it really doesn't add it doesn't add anything to your argument. Okay, with respect to the original dismissal of the original complaint without prejudice, could you address, I guess, two problems? One is the district judge clearly did not think that was a final judgment, the order says only I'm dismissing the complaint, not the action.
Correct.
And Lee and Elmore both dealt with dismissals of the actions.
That's right. And as I acknowledged, Your Honor, neither side has found a case that deals with the precise facts here, which is what happens when a case is dismissed without prejudice and becomes final because of the running of the statute.
I may be leaping ahead, but if there's no case law on this, doesn't that make for a pretty strong equitable tolling argument for a pro se litigant who's being reasonably diligent?
It does make for an equitable tolling argument, but that's a different issue as to dismissal of the first complaint.
Sure.
And it's also an issue that Ms. Luvano did not raise in the district court. She did argue equitable tolling, but she didn't say, I didn't understand that the statute of limitations had run on July 14th from the district court's order. There really was an argument about what the extraordinary circumstance was that would warrant equitable tolling.
Did it say anything about extraordinary circumstances? In the reply brief, we got an indication that they did identify some.
Here's what happened. In her brief in opposition to Walmart's motion to dismiss, which is at the record 48, pages 5 to 6, Luvano said the following in support of the equitable tolling argument. She said Luvano clearly acted in good faith by filing her original complaint within 87 days of receiving her right to sue and sought appointment of counsel and filed a motion to proceed in form of papyrus. She said the July 9th order did not have a time frame for when she needed to file an amended complaint. She then said she acted quickly and as the court suggested by filing an amended complaint. Next, she points to the August 19th order where the court said Luvano appears to have timely claims. By August 19th, the statute had already run, so that order couldn't have misled her into thinking she had more time. The district court found this explanation insufficient to establish equitable tolling, and we suggest that this conclusion was not an abuse of discretion. On appeal, Luvano argues that the July 9th order misled her. That argument wasn't really made in the district court. As I said before, what she said was the order said I can amend, but it didn't set a time frame. Luvano did not argue in the district court that I understood I had as long as I needed to file an amended complaint. She offers no explanation whatsoever as to why she couldn't file an amended complaint between July 14th and August 4th, which was the date that she did. She also argues, in support of her diligence argument, that she continued to meet every court-imposed deadline thereafter. And while that's true in the district court, it's somewhat irrelevant to what she did in between the time of July 14th and August 4th to support equitable tolling. We believe the absence of an explanation on that point alone warrants that the decision be affirmed based on the abuse of discretion standard.
Ms. Zeitler, if I could, let me go back to the question about the original complaint. And let's take a different area of the law. Let's suppose we've got a negligence claim involving an automobile accident, okay, which is filed one day before the statute of limitations runs. It's not unusual. People wait, want to see how far the injury progresses and so on. And let's suppose after Iqbal, an aggressive district judge decides, well, there's something missing here, and a week later dismisses it without prejudice, sua sponte. Plaintiff comes back with an amended complaint that fixes the problem, real or perceived. Has the statute of limitations run?
I would suggest that the statute of limitations has run if it doesn't relate back to the first complaint.
Yeah,
actually,
but of course
it's already
it
dismissed.
Of course it relates
and
back.
And it's dismissed,
rule.
So it's as if the first dismissal relation back does not work in that situation.
You would take the position that under those circumstances, the statute of limitations bars the action.
I would.
So you have support for that.
I don't. I'm.
That would be highly unusual. We have an elaborate body of law that under Rule 15C dealing with relation back of amendments that add parties.
That's correct.
But if all you're doing is fixing a technical problem, a specification problem, let's say, or maybe a fraud claim that wasn't quite particular enough, those don't get dismissed on statute of limitations grounds, do they?
Your Honor, I respectfully can't answer that question. My suggestion is that in the Title VII context, where Congress has indicated that there's a 90-day statute of limitations period, the purpose of that statute of limitations is to bring the complaint either to discussion or to dismissal if the statute hasn't met, because damages continue to accrue, and that's why there's a short statute of limitations.
Could we go back? You asserted that the EEOC determined this claim was without merit.
I asserted that the it was a no-action charge.
Did they investigate?
The first charge?
Yes.
Would you like me to go outside the record?
The right to sue letter was issued very quickly, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you respond to the notice of the charge?
Did I?
Did Walmart?
No, Your Honor. A no action. And again, this is outside the record.
Yeah.
A no action letter was issued based on the intake questionnaire and the EEOC's determination that the conduct wasn't about sex.
Okay, but they did that without investigating, apparently.
They interviewed Ms. Lovano, and based on what she told them during the interview and what she said in the intake questionnaire, they determined that what she was complaining about was mistreatment by a coworker that was based on the coworker's dislike of her because he believed that Ms. Lovano, had gotten his wife fired.
Okay, the EEOC obviously didn't get the additional information that's been provided to the district court.
Clearly,
the Fourth Amended complaint states a cause of action, right?
I beg your pardon?
The Fourth Amended complaint clearly states claims, right?
Yes, it does.
For both discrimination and retaliation.
Yes, it does. We would not have challenged.
So if that had been filed in front of the EEOC, they would have at least had to investigate, right?
Yes, and in fact, Your Honor, we would not have challenged the sufficiency of the allegations. Mm-hmm. The problem with the first complaint is that even the allegations that are pointed to on appeal don't suggest that the conduct was because of sex. And that was the problem that the district court found in screening.
But didn't the district judge overlook the allegations about what the supervisor had done?
Your Honor, if you look at the allegations about what the supervisor said under this court's precedent, I would suggest that they don't state a claim under Iqbal or Twombly or anything else, because the allegations don't say that he did those things, the supervisor did those things because of her sex. And in addition,
he did those things because the alleged harasser was male. Isn't that enough?
I would suggest that
he's treating employees. Can't you infer from that he's treating employees differently based on their sex?
I don't think you can, Your Honor, and I think the district court did not infer that. Beg your pardon?
The facts suggest that the supervisor was protecting the male coworker.
I guess
not a logical inference, or at least a permissible inference?
I would say not. I would say that nobody read the complaint that way below. And when she amended
that, but just to,
I understand.
That's why
I guess the but even when she amended the complaint, that wasn't the allegation. The allegation wasn't that she pointed to the coworker harassment. But even if you look at that allegation and believe that that's because of sex, under this circuit's precedent, it's not sufficiently severe or pervasive to constitute unlawful harassment.
Can we decide that on the pleadings?
Based on what she pled, I believe you can, Your Honor.
But you agree the Fourth Amended complaint is sufficient?
The Fourth
at
Amended
at a 12B6 standard.
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
I believe with respect to, I'd just like to go back to equitable tolling. I believe with respect to extraordinary circumstance, the question is whether a district court judge has an obligation to tell a pro se plaintiff how much time she has left on statute of limitations, because that's essentially what Ms. Lovano is asking this court to do. And I would suggest that there's no support for that, and in fact that could lead to more confusion.
Under these circumstances, though, with a pro se litigant being reasonably diligent, in the summer of 2010, who knew what pleading standards required, even among lawyers, district judges, and judges of this court? Why wouldn't it be reasonable to expect a district judge to not deny the IFP motion, but to simply keep it under advisement while the plaintiff has an opportunity to file an amended complaint and fix the perceived problems in the complaint so that the statute remains tolled? We have a number of cases, including the ones you've cited, where we've said, look, you've got to be reasonable about the way we interpret these rules and not use them to shut courthouse doors.
Right, I understand that, and I would say that the district court could have done that, but didn't.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't it reasonable to say it should have?
I think the answer, Your Honor, is that wouldn't cure the deficiency in the first complaint, so then plaintiff should have argued to the district court, judge, you should have, as part of her reason for applying equitable tolling, Your Honor, you could have denied or left the motion to proceed in form of papyrus pending so that the statute wouldn't have run. Perhaps Ms. Lovano could not have made that argument pro se when she filed her second amended complaint, but certainly her court-appointed counsel could have made that argument, and she didn't.
Does your argument here for affirmance depend upon a difference between IFP procedures and other procedures where amended complaints routinely relate back to the date of the original filing?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will hear from Ms. Felice in rebuttal.
May it please the Court, I'm Marjorie Felice for appellant. And I would like to use our remaining time for rebuttal to just quickly respond to a few of the points you just heard in Walmart's argument. First of all, I would like to clarify that the equitable tolling argument and the jurisdiction argument are completely separate questions before this Court. Walmart's conflating of the two issues creates some confusion, but this Court should consider them separately. Now, as to the extraordinary circumstances, I'd also like to clarify that Ms. Lovano does not contend that the district court should have calculated the statute of limitations for a pro se plaintiff. Simply, had she given her notice that the statute of limitations still applied, that would have been sufficient. Now, I'd also like to comment on relation back. As Judge Hamilton has suggested, it's clear that relation back applies in this case. Ms. Louvenot always consistently throughout her complaints alleged supervisor harassment, supervisor discrimination. Her complaints all related to her supervisor, and that's the heart of what the second complaint and the fourth complaint share and why relation back should apply. Now, these claims before the district court were dismissed too hastily, and Ms. Louvenot should have been heard on the merits. And this court can reverse on either relation back or equitable tolling, or can, because this court has jurisdiction over the first complaint, this court can also reverse on the merits of the first complaint.
I think the district court did not understand the argument to be a relation back under Rule 15 kind of argument. It appears to me that the district court interpreted that footnote that I referred to earlier as an exhaustion requirement, an exhaustion discussion and not a relation back argument, because she specifically says in a footnote in her own opinion that the plaintiff isn't arguing relation back, and here's why that's, you know, was a good thing, because it doesn't apply in the district court's view.
Yes, Your Honor, and we believe that was error. When Walmart raised relation back in its own brief, and Ms. Louvenot in her brief responded to it, so it was presented to the district court, and the district court erroneously considered that it hadn't been, but we asked that this court look to those original briefs where it was raised to see that it was, in fact, presented below. If there are no further questions, we ask that you reverse and remand. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you. And our thanks to all counsel, and especially our thanks to the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern Law School for your assistance to the court and your client. You have the thanks of the court. We'll take the case under advisement.